Hello, I'm Anna Lutfi and this is The Verdict. It's brought to you by the Dixon Poon School of Law, King's College London, and it's a radical experiment in legal podcasting. We bring the law closer to the public in a world where legislation, regulation and the courts seem increasingly remote. In Britain and the United States, there's a real problem with disruption to critical infrastructure. And key municipal operations face mysterious attacks from cyber extortionists, which is not a term that I'm familiar with. Maybe we'll learn more about that as we speak. On a daily basis, outdated software security mechanisms are hijacked, and we've seen increases in counterfeiting, particularly with respect to trademarks and copyright, and proceeds from counterfeit funding criminal activities online. So on The Verdict today, we're going to discuss these primary threat actors, rising levels of counterfeit, and the digital tools we can use to find actual sources of online criminal behaviour. And I am thrilled to welcome today Special Agent Matt Swenson from the Cybercrime Centre Homeland Security Investigations, Alexander Urbelis, who is Senior Counsel for Cybersecurity in the New York office of Crowell & Mooring, and a founding member of the Human Rights First Technology Advisory Board, and Frederick Mostert, Professor of Law at King's College London. So, Matt, if I may start with you, I've been talking about this pandemic of cybercrime. Can you say a little bit about the failings of traditional approaches to cybersecurity and what we need to do to change traditional law enforcement methods?
No, absolutely, and thank you for inviting me to speak today. I think overall one of the major concerns is that cybersecurity tends to be very reactive in nature. So, my experience in the world of cybersecurity is that a lot of times you're standing around waiting, looking at network traffic as it traverses the network, and then responding to something after the fact. And a lot of times you can see, ransomware being a very good example of this, is that after the fact, it's too late. It's too late to respond once your entire network has been encrypted and there's nothing you can do about it, or very, very little that you can do about it. So, one of the things that we've been doing is trying to change the mindset from being reactive in nature to being more proactive in nature. So actively threat hunting and looking for vulnerabilities before they're exploited by cyber criminals. And that's, government is not the quickest, most nimble entity in the world, right? People think of government bureaucracy and red tape, and law enforcement on my side is we're not a totally absolved of that. We get mired down in that type of bureaucracy as well. And there's a lot of what we do is looking at statistics and arrests, indictments, convictions, and these types of metrics, which don't necessarily translate well to the cyber world. So one of the things that we're doing is trying to take a more proactive response, and also how we measure success. So, looking at something like a cyber disruption where, hey, maybe it's not an arrest, indictment, conviction, or a seizure or something of that nature, but because of what we did and supplying a notification to an entity that, hey, you're vulnerable, can you patch this? Can you look and make sure that you haven't been breached? And they go out and they mitigate that vulnerability and they stop the threat actor before they're able to kind of laterally move across the network and exfiltrate key data and lock the network down with ransomware. That's as significant to us as our traditional law enforcement metrics. So it's changing that mindset. One of the other things I think that's very significant is information sharing on the side of the good guys, because hackers they're readily sharing information about how we operate, how they get caught. They're sharing law enforcement affidavits amongst each other, and they're learning from how we do things and how they make mistakes, and they're getting better, they're adapting. And law enforcement, the private sector, we tend to be more siloed, and the information sharing processes that we have are not the most, you know, nimble and dynamic and whatnot. So, you know, you look at the mutual legal assistance treaty process, which is normally how countries and law enforcement share data amongst each other. That process can take months and months. Well, on the cyber side, you don't have months. You have minutes, you know, or hours a lot of time in order to respond to these. It's a very, very quick, dynamic, moving environment. And so I think the pandemic highlights that, in that we had a massive rush of cyber fraud, of web domains being stood up, thousands of tens of thousands, literally overnight, to where we had to decide, hey, what are we going to do with these? You know, they're defrauding people. They're launching malicious software. They're stealing people's money. They're harvesting credentials. They're doing all these types of things that cyber fraudsters like to do. And we need to work together amongst ourselves to be able to formulate a strategy. And that's initially how, you know, I came into contact with Frederick and Alex, was trying to formulate a strategy to combat COVID-19 related fraudulent activity. And it wasn't through an official process. It was just through relationship building and talking amongst each other. And I think all of that leads to things like an MOU, which enables us to more easily share information and dealing with these types of dynamic situations. Because, you know, a lot of the processes that we have right now on the books, we're just not able to do that. And we're putting ourselves at a massive disadvantage dealing with cyber criminals, because they're talking to each other every day. They're on cyber underground criminal forums, dark web forums, and they're instantly sharing information with each other. And we need to be doing the same on the side of the good guys.
Can I very quickly clarify that the rise in cybercrime because of the pandemic, is that as a result of the fact that more transactions are taking place online?
Absolutely. You know, yeah. I liken it to kind of the perfect storm or the perfect conditions for, you know, cyber criminals to, you know, conduct business. It's a combination of things. One, you have a lot of people working from home. They're now online. They're not going to their normal meetings. They're sitting behind a computer all day. So they're more active online. And two, you have a large percentage of the population that's desperate for information, right? Particularly at the very beginning of the onset of the pandemic, there wasn't a lot of freely available information. So they were going online searching for anything. And the problem with that is it's very easy to redirect those people to malicious sites, right? Via spear phishing and spear texting and all these types of things that they normally do. They're exploiting a vulnerable percentage of the population. A large percent of the most desperate percentage of the population are the ones who are most desperate for information, and they are not necessarily the most tech savvy. So they fall prey to these types of schemes, you know, maybe more easily than, you know, people who are more comfortable with the technology. So it kind of created the perfect conditions for cyber fraud. And cyber fraudsters, you know, there's no scruples amongst them, right? They take advantage of whatever pandemic, like the greater the pandemic, the greater the opportunity for them. And so, unfortunately, they kind of know no bounds with what they're willing to do in order to defraud people.
Frederick, you want to jump in and then we'll move to Alex, because we can talk more about what they actually do and how it works.
So I have a follow-up question, Matt, and this is something which is very close to my heart. For years, we've been looking at exactly the point you raised there, sharing of information, because on the one hand, the bad actors are so good at coordinating with each other. And on the other hand, as you said, the good guys are very slow on the uptake on coordinating information and sharing digital tools to combat the criminals online. And the issue has been in the past, especially in Europe, that there is GDPR and privacy, but one of the recognized provisions under GDPR is to share information when you are looking at criminal conduct for law enforcement authorities. But because of this natural resistance on sharing details, there should be, I believe, some basic mechanism to share this very type of information across borders with law enforcement authorities, and also at the same time, public-private sharing of information. When private companies come across nefarious conduct, there should be a way in which they should share that with law enforcement, and then law enforcement do it across borders, because as we know, the bad actors are really international, they're global. Think of them, I think, at sometimes of multinationals operating at an international level. They do things which are tax-free. They've got the conduit to do things internationally and across borders. But I'd be very keen to hear your thoughts on how we can create those mechanisms to share.
No, those are all very good points, Frederick. And you can see it firsthand. So, and we have the same difficulties here in the United States. There's a huge push for information sharing and reporting of cyber incidents. And there's been a lot of pushback, and I completely understand, private entities and organizations' stance on this. They get hacked and now they're outed as a victim, and they have to, explain to their customer base, hey, we've been hacked, your information's been leaked out, and all that type of stuff, and they don't necessarily want it to be public. And we have that problem with law enforcement as well, is that, eventually, if we go to prosecute a cyber criminal, we're gonna use that information in, search warrants and affidavits and court stuff, and it's potentially gonna come to light. And I think there needs to be a change on how we view victims of cyber attacks, and that it can happen to anybody. And we've seen that. We've seen companies, companies like FireEye, who are a gigantic, the largest potentially cybersecurity company. If they can be hacked, anybody can be hacked, right? No matter how good your cybersecurity posture is. And so then how do we get people to, one, report? And if they do report, how do we share that and disseminate that information in a timely fashion? Because it's not enough just to disseminate it. You need it right away. And, a lot of times we get stuff on the classified side, and it takes months and months to declassify and get it out into a usable product that actually works well. And I think the best answer of what I've seen, at least here domestically within the United States, is when you create entities where government and the private sector sit together in the same building and work together. So a real good example of this is the National Cyber or Computer Forensic Training Alliance and the NCFTA, where business, law enforcement, government, they all sit together and they all freely share information amongst each other, and they do it real time because they're all working together, they're all sitting in the same place, and they're all working as one unified team. I think that that's a really good model that we could expand, and we could expand it internationally to where, we have these large scale working groups where everybody's meeting on a regular basis and we're all sharing, information together. Because like you said, Frederick, it's global. It's very rare that we work a cyber investigation that's just domestic within the U.S. Most of the bad actors reside, overseas or in another country. So it's a huge problem, and we're all trying to figure it out.
Thanks. It's really fascinating to think about the speed at which this is happening, and then the global dimension. So you're chasing rainbows in a way. It requires very strategic thinking and huge technical expertise. And I know, Alex, you have this fascinating history as not only a highly successful intellectual property lawyer, but you are a hacker, a former hacker, I should say. And you have the sort of psychological understanding of the mindset and the speed at which people have to work, and how, one solution can be very temporary because new problems are invented all the time. So as you solve one, there's a new one on the horizon. Can you tell us a little bit about how you how you came into this area, and also about the sort of domain tracking work that you do, and why it's so important.
Yeah, sure thing, Anna, absolutely. And thank you for having me, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to speak to you all. You mentioned I was a hacker, and I think going from hacker to lawyer, many would accuse me, frankly, of going from bad to worse. But curiously enough, though, in large part, it was really my misspent youth that has propelled the trajectory of my legal career. And I still maintain my connections with the hacker community. I think it's really important. And that community has morphed, or perhaps overlapped is a better word, with the cybersecurity community for some time now. I mean, Matt mentioned, you know, places like FireEye and whatnot. I mean, those are organizations that have tons of what we would consider hackers within their ranks. And having this hacker background and being one of the good guys has really opened up doors to me. I found myself working in places that the 15-year-old hacker me would have never expected in my entire life. I worked for the U.S. Army JAG Corps on some privacy issues. I worked for a federally funded think tank at Dartmouth, the Institute for Security Technology Studies, where we focused on counterterrorism and cybersecurity issues. That then led me to CIA and the Office of General Counsel, and clerking for the chief judge at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, Steptoe to Richmond as in-house cybersecurity and CCO, working with Frederick, and then to running my own firm, creating a unique threat intelligence platform that monitors the global domain name system, to the acting chief information security officer of the NFL, and recently, my latest move was to Kroll and Mooring as senior counsel for cybersecurity. But frankly, though, to me, being a hacker is less about technical skills and more about having a mindset, perhaps even a certain type of philosophical outlook akin to maintaining a childlike relationship towards the world. And I think being a hacker is really about being unafraid to take things apart and to ask questions, and being unafraid also to be wrong. It's about learning systems and processes and finding the vulnerabilities in those systems. And I really believe that the best lawyers out there have this kind of mindset. And I think that the best lawyers are hackers, even if they might not know it. And to build on something that Matt said too, I think, you know, this hacker mentality is all about sharing information. It's not about finding a vulnerability and exploiting it for your own personal gain. That's what the bad guys do. That's what the threat actors do. The good hackers are going to be sharing that information. And you maintain this type of philosophy, I think, that starts in your youth to your adulthood, where if you learn something, if you have this information, you should be sharing it with your peers, with the private sector, with the government sector. And that's exactly how this MOU has arisen between King's College and ZHS. And I'm happy to be a part of that.
That was one of the things I was going to move on to, is the relationship between the public and private sector. So I'm glad you brought it up. How important is that collaboration? And then, you know, what sort of issues do the different sectors have to highlight as they move to collaborate with each other? I mean, what are the most important key areas?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the need for this sort of multidisciplinary collaboration, you know, not just tech people, but a multidisciplinary approach involving lawyers, involving tech people, involving perhaps even, you know, HR, which is a huge part of the cybersecurity ecosystem these days. And I think this need for multidisciplinary collaboration is really critical from a sector-wide perspective. But I also believe that we, as professionals ourselves, need to be evolving towards better multidisciplinary expertise. And to be an excellent cybersecurity lawyer, for example, I just don't think it's enough anymore to be good at reading statutes, regulations, policies, what have you, to contextualize the importance of these legal requirements. One has to also understand the technology, how it works, how it's exploited, and how we can begin to change and improve our processes to enable better defensive actions. This could sound like a lot of fluff, but I think to go from the general to the specific, a great example of where we need better and faster multidisciplinary collaboration is exactly what Matt had mentioned. And I think it's in threat detection and response, being proactive and sharing this type of intelligence.
So can you give some really specific examples of multidisciplinary collaboration? Because I totally understand what you're saying. I mean, someone like you who's got the technical skills as a hacker, former hacker, you can speak to perhaps to law enforcement in the way that an academic lawyer with no experience is just, you know, that collaboration I can see is much more robust between someone with the technical skills and someone with the law enforcement priorities. But can you give some really specific examples of a multidisciplinary collaboration and success stories, perhaps?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think examples are really the best way to illustrate this, because on a very general level, it's tough to conceptualize it. I think, so next month, for example, will be 3 years that I've been tracking a really sophisticated group of cyber adversaries that I believe several different state actors have likely employed to obtain initial access to organizations and companies. And I've personally assisted over 150 organizations that have been targeted. But the total number of entities this group has had in their sites is well over 1,700. And most of these organizations are in what we would consider in the US and the UK to be part of critical infrastructure. But when you identify impending cyber attacks on nearly 20 organizations from the same group simultaneously, it's quite literally impossible to give advance notice to everyone. It's like being in an ER or an A&E. It becomes a matter of triaging, and you have to look at the companies and assign them an urgency level, you know, look at your own workload, and then make the appropriate noises to the most critical of those that are going to be affected, and hope that your notification is heeded or that they get back to you. So this information sharing component, I think, has to be a lot more rapid, especially given the volume of the attacks that we're seeing. And this is, I think, a great example, too, where we have had a measure of success sharing this information with federal authorities and law enforcement, and there being, I think, swift reactions on that part, too.
I have to ask you then about the recent state-sponsored attack on the World Health Organization in March 2020. Not so recent, actually. It's just time flies. But you were you were involved in the detection of that attack at the height of the entire world shutting down because of the coronavirus pandemic. So you would have seen firsthand how it is possible to get an immediate response, bringing various actors together very quickly. Would you like to say a little bit about your involvement in that and what you learned from it?
Absolutely. And also, I think it's another great example. And I think some additional context would be helpful, too. So going back to March 2020, when I detected this live attack on the World Health Organization, things were literally going off the hook. And now, I was watching the threat actors that targeted the WHO for some time. And these bad guys were very intriguing because they were exclusively trying to compromise IGOs or intergovernmental organizations, places like the World Food Program, UNICEF, the United Nations, Council on Foreign Relations, and quite a few other similarly situated organizations. When I saw this group activate certain infrastructure that I was monitoring in the DNS, the domain name system, and then use that infrastructure to target the WHO. Yeah, I made those appropriate noises to the right people. The attack was unsuccessful. But it's critical to point out, and this is the context I was mentioning, that these bad guys also targeted the WHO nearly half a dozen times prior to March 2020. They were also in their sites way before this. It's those attacks that concern me most, because it's one thing to target an organization while it's on high alert, and another thing entirely to quietly breach and establish persistence within an organization's networks. And that's why I think data sharing, both from the private and public sector, real actual data sharing about not only actual events that are happening now, but historical cyber attacks can be really effective at terminating future incidents. Because what do those future incidents turn into when you establish persistence in a network? Think about ransomware as a service, where you have initial access brokers on the one side and the guys that deploy the ransomware on the other. Those credentials harvesting attacks can very easily turn into ransomware events later on. And that's why I think sharing data about historical attacks is really could be a very effective way to terminate future incidents. So in any event, the height of the pandemic was also just unprecedented on many levels. And again, this will get back to something that Matt had mentioned. Using the domain name system intelligence platform that I developed, I started monitoring just for the term Corona in February 2020 to check in, see what kind of activity was happening on a day-to-day basis. And to give you a little more background, think about the Super Bowl, a sporting event that for the most part the whole world watches or at least has some interest in. And you may see about 10 to 20 Super Bowl related domains being registered on a daily basis leading up to the event itself. And that's a lot for an individual or an organization to investigate. And when I started tracking the coronavirus domains at the end of February 2020, I started seeing over 200 domains being registered per day. And then it jumped to 400, and then it jumped to 600, and then it was over 1,000. At one point, at the height of the hysteria of the coronavirus, we were catching over 3,500 new coronavirus domain names being registered per day. This is a volume and a velocity of domain registrations that has never existed in the history of the internet before. And a significant subset of those domains also, as Matt had mentioned earlier, were used for fraud, for phishing, for misinformation, for credentials harvesting, and other illicit activities, counterfeiting, et cetera. So in keeping with this trend of monitoring the DNS, I've also been keeping tabs and working with DHS on vaccine-related domains, as well as DNS activity that relates to the pharmaceutical ecosystem and others in that vaccine supply chain. And not surprisingly, there's a lot of activity. And so for the last 9 months or so, it's been, you know, a real pleasure and honor to work with Matt and his colleagues at DHS to assist with monitoring that ecosystem. And I think it's a really good example of the private-public partnership that that should be encouraged.
Yes, Frederick, please.
So I have a quick follow-up question, Alex. I think it's so important in any form of law enforcement to track and trace the origin of crime. And we know that in the analog world, you can't really stamp something out until you find the original hierarchy and the origin of crime. And it's equally important on the web. But the problem with the web, there is even more shields. So you have servers in different countries and you don't know where to find where the origins are. But as I've seen and witnessed myself, your new, what I call your new cool tool, your digital enforcement checking on domain names and the origins and where they originate is just fascinating. It's such an eye-opener. And I think it's probably helpful to the audience just to explain what you have developed, a system. It's driven by your own invention of code and a whole system of setting up and tracing domain names. And then also something I never knew until I started working with you on this a few years ago, the importance of subdomains to trace the origins. But maybe briefly you can mention what you've developed there for the audience, because it's fascinating.
Oh, sure thing. Absolutely, Frederick. And yeah, I mean, even lawyers can write some interesting source code every once in a while, right? So this is, it's a very interesting platform. And I designed it to be effective at detecting early stage indicators of cyber attacks in the global domain name system, because it's such a vector of attack. You know, and exactly for, again, I keep going back to Matt's excellent points at the outset of this, but to be proactively scanning for these early stage indicators so that when we find them, and as you mentioned, Frederick, we can then begin to connect the dots behind the scenes, find additional infrastructure that may belong to this group of threat actors, find other domains that are registered or other vectors of attack that they may be utilizing, and turn those off before they even hit the organization, using things like legal process, efficient takedown mechanisms, partnerships, public-private partnerships as well. Once you have this data amassed about the network itself, it becomes a lot easier to deal with it and handle it. And also, as you mentioned, Frederick, you know, the global domain name system itself is not just the registered domains that you get from GoDaddy. There are a lot of other components of the DNS, and in particular subdomains. So those are the things that you would have CNN.com. CNN would be the domain name. .com is the top level domain. And to the left of CNN, if you had something like mail.cnn.com, that mail would be a subdomain. And those subdomains are created at the host, at the, you know, whoever's hosting that particular website. It's called an A record or a DNS A record. You don't have to go through GoDaddy or Namecheap or anybody to create that. You just create it on your own server. And so you can name it whatever you want. There's very few records that you can track for subdomains. So subdomains being layered on top of generic sounding domains that aren't going to set off any alarms because they may not be infringing trademark rights or IP rights for ordinary brand protection systems is a very effective and really malicious way to create real looking URLs or real looking website addresses that are used by sophisticated cyber adversaries for advanced credentials harvesting and phishing. And that's exactly the type of thing that I've developed some unique methodologies to track and trace and identify before they hit an organization. And that's been some of the more interesting work that I've been up to over the last couple of years. So thank you for asking about that.
Can I just say, as a complete layperson and someone who's witnessed firsthand some of the things you're talking about, when I tried to apply for my ESTA visa to enter the United States, which was then free of charge for British citizens, I remember wrestling with all of these fake ESTA visa domains that were charging me for what I knew was a free visa. So that was many years ago. This has been going on with the invention of the World Wide Web. But obviously what you're saying, all of you, is that the pandemic has thrown us into something of a crisis because, you know, these assaults are relentless. They're from every direction. And we don't know whether we're dealing with individual entities, individuals sometimes, or criminal networks, or even countries. And it just reminds me of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, where, you know, the best analogy is like a sort of alien invasion, where you have this complete assault from something that you can't even name what it is. And I wondered if perhaps all of you would be interested in taking this conversation to a discussion on a more esoteric level about the nature of war and whether you see the work that you do is actually engaging in warfare, combating an enemy, and who that enemy is or how you conceptualize the cyber enemy, as opposed to more traditional understandings of war where you have either terrorist cells or specific countries fighting one another over resources or whatever. So I don't know who would like to kick that ball off into the pitch. Maybe Frederick and then Matt, and then we can return to Alex.
Yes. Thank you, Anna. I think, as we all have seen in the popular media, you have these analogies drawn from a more general perspective, talking about cyber warfare. But also, I've seen some very interesting reports on BBC and I think CBS and so on, where there are all these analogies drawn of you have in traditional conventional warfare, boots on the ground in a specific territory, but with cyber warfare, it really goes much, much further into, not cross borders and international, in home territory, into people's homes, and trying to capture their hearts and minds and interfering with elections, interfering with pandemic efforts at dealing with, and Alex may be able to talk about this more personally, of, you know, dealing with these misinformation and deceptive information which could cost lives. So it's much more of a local and close warfare. But I would like to throw something out there and suggest, and I'd love to hear what both Matt and Alex have to say, but I think, generally speaking, at this juncture, if a cyber incident inflicts serious damage to critical national infrastructure and significantly harms national security, I believe that may rise to the level of war, as we traditionally know war, but in a larger context, because in the traditional context, it's physical, and you're dealing with a type of kinetic warfare, while in cyberspace, you're in a different parallel universe, but the harm could not only be the same, but even worse. So the question is, if you look at the end result and what happens in society, whether you can't justifiably say that. So I went far back to the father of international private law, Hugo Grotius, in De Jure Praedi, in some number of centuries ago in the Middle Ages, where he's contended, very interesting to see this, if you look forward into the future in cyber warfare, you go back into the past centuries ago, where he lay down the initial groundwork of in De Jure Belli et Pacis, in other words, the law of war and peace. He contended that every human being possesses the right to carry on private wars in very specific, obviously, specific circumstances. and that he drew the analogy there is with self-defense. As we know, self-defense and necessity in tort law, the analogy too in the doctrine of hot pursuit where you go across borders, the same type of analogies I think might be applicable in cyberspace, where if you are attacked on your computer system, how can you respond? So it was quite interesting a few years ago, as very initial discussions at hacking conferences, which I attended, of are you allowed to hack back? And there were views on both sides of the equation, but I think the prevailing view at that juncture was very resistant to allow cyber attacks to go back and hack back because of the concern about vigilantes who would go overboard and the concerns that would happen. But since SolarWinds and since the World Health Organization attack, there's a lot more discussion in the area of hacking back, but within certain very strict guided principles with the help of, for instance, courts and other institutions within government to deal with these issues. Because in a sense, sometimes to defend yourself, you have to go on the offensive. So it's a fascinating analogy to look at cyber warfare and how it affects all of us. But I would much rather hear from the experts themselves as to what they think is relevant in this area.
Matt, do you want to jump in here, or it doesn't matter which one of you?
No, absolutely. And it's a fascinating topic. And I think, you know, Frederick really hit the nail on the head. Some people look at the cyber world as like this abstract concept, right? And I've been saying this for a very long time. I've been in law enforcement as a cyber investigator for almost 20 years. And in the early 2000s, I used to say that, you know, all crime is going to be cyber crime at some point in time. And we're already seeing that. If we're not there already, we're real close to where any type of criminal activity has some sort of cyber component, right? And you see that from very sophisticated nation state actors all the way down to, you know, a gang activity and narcotics cartels. They're all using technology now to facilitate criminal activity. And I think war is similar to that, in that now in modern war, you have a cyber component to almost everything that people are doing, that armies are doing. But it's really strange to me on how we view things. And this is no different than the criminal world, in that because it happens out in cyberspace, there's somehow less significance to it. And I use the analogy of this. And if you had somebody break and enter your house and came in the middle of the night, and they kicked your door open, and they came in, and they rummaged through your stuff, even if they didn't take anything, if you called the police, and they showed up, and they found somebody in your house, they would arrest that person, right? And they would be charged with breaking and entering. But somehow, when we add the cyber component to that, that act is not enough a lot of time for these people to be prosecuted, right? And we do the same thing in war, where if we were to land troops, you know, into a sovereign nation, that would be a declaration of war. I think universally across the board amongst every nation, if you landed a platoon of troops into their city's capital and they were armed and said, hey, here we are, they would take that as a declaration of war. They would be resistant to that. However, in the cyber world, we're doing these types of intrusions into sovereign territory on a daily basis. And somehow there's these weird, abstract, unwritten rules of when you've gone too far and what you can hack and what you can't, but nothing's really clearly delineated. And some countries are willing to do more. You know, you listen to Frederick and, you know, we're talking about interfering in the democratic process and elections, and, you know, certain countries are hacking private entities and stealing their information, you know, stealing citizens' information and harvesting that and keeping it and storing it and all these other types of things that if we did it in the physical world, if we sent, you know, special forces into a country and raided their Capitol building and stole a bunch of paper files, they would want to go to war with us. but yet we do it in the cyber capacity literally every single day, and nobody does anything about it. Or what we do about it is we go and we cyber attack them back. It's a real strange dynamic that I think somehow, because we add that cyber layer to it, people just have a different way of looking at it. And it's really, really an interesting topic.
Yeah, I'd love to jump in there too. And I think these are all excellent points here. And going back to one of Frederick's original queries here, which is, you know, when these cyber actions that can take some form of or can have some kind of kinetic impact, you know, and they rise to this level of an act of war, I think we're getting into really dangerous territory there. And, you know, I think, you know, restraint, frankly, is really key. And I worry about other countries around the world being subject to the type of cyber attacks like the U.S. and United Kingdom have been subject to for some time, who may not have the same type of restraint that the United States or United Kingdom does. And there is now very much a blurring of the lines between state actors, state-sponsored actors, and private parties that may knowingly or frankly unknowingly or some combination of the two be working on behalf of a state or even multiple states. And these private parties, they're not going to have signed contracts with China or Russia. They're not going to have some kind of documentation that establishes quite clearly, you know, who their actual clients are. They're going to be working through intermediaries, and they're going to be working through intermediaries who may be working through other intermediaries themselves. So on the one hand, I can look at a fact pattern or the attack vector that caused a breach or an incident, and frankly, I can make a quick assessment about whether it involved a sophisticated cyber actor like a state. There are certain telltale signs there, but attribution to a specific state is still a very difficult and a very difficult project. It's a very difficult thing to do, and I think it's getting more and more tricky week by week here, because adversaries are getting much more effective at emulating each other's TTPs, which is known in the community as stands for tactics, techniques, and procedures. And that can allow one adversary to, let's say, emulate, you know, what China would do, or use the same type of malware, or the same types of techniques, tactics, and procedures that China or Russia would do, or a combination of those. I mean, I've seen false flags where four or five different countries are implicated in the same piece of malware or the same incident. And so all of this can lead investigators down the wrong path, which goes back to my original point that I think, you know, restraint here is key when we're thinking about acts of war. But also to go back to Frederick's point about this concept of active defense, when is it okay to punch back or to hit back? I think it's certainly the domain of people who work for organizations like DHS, CIA, NSA, and other governmental organizations, people like Matt, that should be taking those types of actions. You know, where there is, if there's any offensive action, I really, really caution private parties from doing that, because you could be violating federal law in the United States, or I think the Computer Misuse Act in the United Kingdom. There are all kinds of terrible repercussions and consequences for a private party taking such such an offensive action. However, there is a new concept of active defense that's been circulating for a while, and this is I think it's kind of fascinating, because it is based on essentially spinning up the threat actor. If you detect an alien inside your networks, there's a bad guy, there's somebody in there. One way to use active defense internally would be to create a diversion within your own network, to create some kind of virtual infrastructure, virtual file servers, virtual active directories that are out there that lead the attacker down the wrong path and essentially spin him up, get him really interested in compromising this other infrastructure. And what you've done is contain him or her in this virtual infrastructure that has nothing to do with your actual organization. And while that person is contained, you are all the while collecting information, collecting intelligence, trying to trace back their IP address, you know, maybe even contacting the various hosts through which they could be hopping, essentially like tracing a phone call. Remember when that was a thing back in the, you know, the 80s and the 90s. But it allows you to track and possibly trace this particular threat actor by spinning them up, keeping them occupied within your own virtual infrastructure. And that doesn't cross any legal lines. That doesn't break any laws. You are free to play with and toy with a threat actor as you see fit if they are on your networks. And that's some of the more fun stuff, I think, that that we're going to be seeing happening more frequently in the days to come.
Are we moving to a world, though, where surveillance becomes so necessary and fundamentally integrated into every aspect of our lives, governance and all the institutions and all of our interactions and our consumer purchases, our relationships, that we start to take surveillance for granted? I mean, I have heard theories that say we've basically consented tacitly to the abolition of our privacy in exchange for all of the perceived benefits of living and working online. Are we in danger of taking mass surveillance for granted as individuals in the name of the common good, which is to fight these cyber criminals or these hostile actors? We will just have to all accept that we're potentially under surveillance all the time. Is that something that you think is an important human rights angle on the discussion that we're having? Frederick, I know you care a lot about this.
I'll be very brief, but I'd much rather defer to experts here. But just one thought on that. If you look at the attention merchants written by Professor Tim Wu and also to some extent Professor Shoshana Zuboff's analysis of these issues, that's already happened, and according to them, 10 years ago. This is this kind of unwritten pact that we've given away so many rights of privacy and data collection, to some extent, probably subconsciously, but it's already fact and it's already out there. The question to my mind at this juncture is, how do we retrieve some of that? And I believe if you look at the concept and you expand it a little, as we have in the Equitas principles of digital literacy, that people should become more savvy online and how they do things, simple tools like authenticating and checking things. There are sites and more of these, and even the platforms are starting to develop tools. How you authenticate what you buy is authentic, as a very simple example to deal with all the counterfeit issues and piracy issues, but more importantly, to start looking at how you authenticate information and things like news. People need to become slightly more fact-checking oriented, and there are tools that are being developed at present, and I think that's going to have to become a very crucial part of our daily life and our culture and our mindset on how we deal with the new parallel universe, i.e. the cyber world around us. But I'd rather defer to these two experts.
I can jump in there as well if you'd like. I think this is such an interesting topic, and I think you both have hit on really important concepts here. You know, especially in the United States, when you think about the U.S. Constitution, nowhere in the U.S. Constitution can you find the word privacy. It's an 18th century document. The concept of privacy was just baked into ordinary life. It was something that really we took for granted, and we codified certain specific situations where we would want privacy, you know, especially from things like the general warrants that, the British used to use against the colonists, you know, these general warrants that would allow you to go in and search for subversive materials in houses. So we now have these requirements of very specific warrants. But privacy, to go back to these guys, if you felt like you were speaking too close to somebody or somebody could perhaps overhear you, then you just walked 10 or 15 feet away. Or you went behind the barn and had your conversation there. That was privacy. It was just always around. But the concept of privacy as a legal doctrine evolved out of the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution that has to deal with unreasonable search and seizures. And that the evolution of it is very interesting because it's based on a subjective notion of what we would believe to have situations in which we would believe, individuals would reasonably believe to have an expectation of privacy. And so the more and more we have given away our private data, our information about our activities, geolocation information, where we are, with whom we consort, where we've traveled, all of this information, when we sign it away in on the basis of these terms of use or privacy policies, every time we do that, we are in effect chipping away at that subjective expectation, that reasonable expectation of privacy that we would have, that makes it objectively less reasonable. And all of this information, remember, is a business record that's being held by Facebook or other social media companies, TikTok, et cetera, for example. It's a business record being held in the possession of a third party for which there are fewer and fewer rights to privacy. And this goes back to I think it was Smith v. Maryland, which established in the United States, the Supreme Court case that established the third party doctrine, that business records in the possession of a third party do not necessarily have the same type of privacy protection, same type of Fourth Amendment protections as purely private records. And going back to what Frederick is saying is that this push towards digital literacy, and I really believe that the Equitas principles that he referenced that are on which he's working, and I think perhaps others over at King's College, are really important here, because I think that there has been a real sea change, an attitude shift towards how we value privacy. And I think a really good example of this are state laws that are coming out, things like the California Consumer Protection Act. You know, maybe not the best designed legislation, but certainly the principle behind it is to give consumers the right to take back into their own hands their data and their right to control their data. And I think we're going to see more and more about that coming out. We see issues even arising from Afghanistan right now and the frankly botched evacuation that's happening because of biometric databases of Afghan nationals being left in Kabul that were used by the U.S. military, which can now be used to identify those who had helped and assisted the U.S. government. I mean, frankly, that to me is shameful in a lot of ways, that we didn't have the foresight about that particular technology falling into the wrong hands. And so I think we're going to be seeing more and more pushback from these terrible situations that are arising to regulate the use of that type of data. But another good example of this is the debate, the massive debate, I think, that's happening right now over CSAM, or child sexual abusive materials. You know, it used to be known as child pornography. And Apple's new innovative way of identifying child pornography that is about to be uploaded to iCloud by using hash matching, essentially using math and cryptography to generate a digital fingerprint on your device of a file that would otherwise have been known to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, on the other hand. And there's been a huge raging privacy debate over whether or not this should be happening. And in my view, I think that's actually a bit misguided. But it really shows that people are conscious and changing their attitudes towards this. My view on the CSAM debacle is that, you know, this is technology that's been in use for at least the last 10 years. Google, Facebook, and others have been hash matching digital files to find child pornography or child sexual abusive materials for many, many times, so that we don't have the slippery slope argument. But I think it is really important now for privacy advocates to pick and choose the battles that they fight here. I think the CSAM one, and I've said this publicly elsewhere, is the wrong battle, because you only have one hill on which you can die. You can't die on two different hills. You only got one hill that you can die on. I think that's the wrong one. But the fact that there are so many people pushing for it is a great indication that people are becoming more digitally literate, more privacy conscious. And so hopefully we're going to be pushing back against that long erosion of our privacy rights that has happened, I think, since the early 2000s.
Matt, how do you react to that from a law enforcement perspective? I mean,
no, I think Alex explained it far more eloquently than I could from a legal perspective, being an attorney. Through our training, you know, one of the things in the United States is that we get extensive training on constitutional law, particularly the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, which Alex discussed is, you know, what we call REP, reasonable expectation of privacy. What's the reasonable expectation of a citizen within the United States that everyone would kind of agree upon? Hey, this is the level of privacy that they should have without government interference. And it's a balancing act every day. With what we do in law enforcement, you look at the, you know, terrorist San Bernardino shooting is a perfect example of that. they recovered an iPhone from the scene, and they want to be able to search the iPhone to see, hey, you know, how extensive was this guy's connections and terrorist organization? Who is he affiliated with? All these other things that may potentially help us to prevent another terrorist attack down the road. And, you know, Apple on their side says, hey, we want to protect the privacy of our customers, and knowing that we freely don't just give this information to law enforcement, and that if, you know, if there's some sort of backdoor mechanism to which law enforcement can get into a device, is that device really secure? Do people really feel secure using that device if they know that, you know, at any given moment, law enforcement can get in? And, you know, Alex really described it well, is what's the hill that we're willing to die on for this? So, like, you know, how far do we go, or what is that reasonable expectation? What is that level? Do you have reasonable expectation if you're committing a crime and we know you're committing a crime and the crime is very egregious, like the, you know, creation and distribution of child exploitation material or a potential terrorist attack that could kill, you know, hundreds of people or thousands of people? And that debate is raging every single day. But I think Alex hit the nail on the head, is that what's the greater, how do we protect the privacy of a populace that's willingly eroding their privacy on a daily basis? They're posting the most intimate details of their everyday life freely available on social media networks. And then they want to come back and say, hey, no, that's, my privacy is protected. You know, it's this crazy dynamic that nobody envisioned when they crafted the United States Constitution, when they crafted similar legal frameworks in other nations around the world. Nobody ever imagined this information age that we're in now, where you can freely disseminate information to millions of people at the snap of a finger, and it's right there on display for everybody. So it's a extremely difficult balancing act for us as law enforcement, and that, you know, a lot of times we have information that the general public doesn't realize. And it's like, hey, that's why we want to get this information. It could potentially save hundreds of lives if we have that. And it's a battle. It's a battle we're fighting every day. We're figuring it out in the courts. And I don't know where we're going to land eventually, but I definitely understand both sides of the coin on it. You know, there is definite need for people to be able to use the internet and feel like, hey, all my data is not being harvested, right? And that's been the beginning of the internet, really. In the initial days, security was a complete afterthought. The World Wide Web was wide open. You know, data was going through in the clear, and then people realized, hey, we should probably build some encryption into this to protect people's data, because if we have a man in the middle and they're, you know, capturing that network traffic, they can see everything. And so we've layered security into that so that people can feel like, hey, I'm free to converse and, you know, go to my banking account and do all these types of transactional data without somebody stealing my information and using it against me. But at the same time, like Alex said, there's this weird erosion where we're just freely giving that data up. And I think that's going to have dire consequences in the long run.
My immediate response, just listening to both of you, well, all three of you, is that the human rights frameworks that I know, because I've studied human rights law and practice in that area, and, you know, you have to familiarize yourself with the European Convention and like documents, is that it just sounds hideously out of date. I mean, there's a kind of balancing act that goes on between Article 8 and Article 10 rights in the Convention, where you have the right to freedom of expression. So the journalists might decide something is in the public interest. They take a photo of someone who then asserts their privacy rights to have that photograph protected or not released into the public domain. And that has been the hill, actually, as you say, this balancing act, you know, these have been the two hills, privacy versus freedom of expression. But what you're talking about collectively is not about privacy versus freedom of expression. It's about a complete paradigm shift where we now we don't as individuals fully understand what rights we have and don't have. And we also don't understand, because we don't work in the fields that you work in, the nature of the threats and the tools that are being developed by the good guys and the bad guys. And so I can only hope that this kind of conversation helps to at least start raising public awareness of the issues, because I think for many people they are really obscure issues and perhaps not particularly interesting on the face of it because they don't work in this field. But I can't imagine anyone who isn't affected by this in the 21st century. So I wonder if we could begin to wrap up this conversation by meditating as a group on what we're speaking from the UK context, Frederick and I, at King's College London. And at the moment, the UK Parliament is seeing a bill making its way slowly through the House. I think they've had the first meeting in July on the draft online safety bill. And I wonder if you had something that you would like to say to, if you could say something to members of Parliament on what that bill should address in terms of the urgent crisis that we've been discussing, what the three of you might say by way of reflection on current legislation. Yeah, Frederick.
I think, well, there are quite a number of comments, but to be succinct, I think one pitfall is, as we've seen a lot of discussion here by the press and even members of Parliament, is that you really need to define crime specifically in this act. If you get into harmful conduct, it's a very, very grey area and it's a very difficult thing to describe. I believe that the first focus should be, because then you very quickly get into justifiable issues of freedom of speech, just as you've outlined now, Anna. I think the best way forward is to start with clear criminal conduct, as we've seen is specifically excluded from GDPR and other privacy acts. So I would like to think there's only one hill, for instance, when it comes to online sexual child abuse. And there's no way around it. How could a perpetrator even possibly suggest that there is some right to privacy or free speech in those circumstances? It goes to basic, not only human rights law, but the law natural to all humankind around the world. You just cannot have that type of conduct. So keep it very clear and simple so that we can really move forward and don't be dragged back and try and discuss everything under one umbrella, online harms as well. Keep it clear and simple and deal with proper, pure criminal conduct and move ahead. And then later on, start looking at the other issues. That's just one comment amongst many, but in the interest of time, let's hear what our colleagues have to say.
Alex.
Sure. I think, you know, the question that you asked, Anna, was, you know, what we should be saying to Parliament or to others. I'm going to mince words here in a sense and be a little lawyerly. I don't think any amount of words are actually going to sink in effectively. I think experts like ourselves should be showing, not necessarily telling or saying things to Parliament and other legislative bodies, Congress as well, showing them what the problem looks like. I'd love the opportunity to take a parliamentary committee down the path of a cyber kill chain. I think that would be very enlightening for them to see what that cyber kill chain looks like, so that they can see the problem and not just hear people pontificating about it. And to go back to the multidisciplinary points that we made earlier, and I think, you know, what you were also referencing in part with respect to human rights and process is that part of the problem we're facing is that we are societies that believe in due process. And the process that is due includes an opportunity to be heard on both sides. These things are not ex parte procedures, meaning that they're one-sided. I mean, our beliefs as societies, as countries, in fairness and process actually cut against us when it comes to responding to impending cyber issues. And with this in mind, I submit that Parliament should be looking into things like the notice and takedown procedures and redesigning such procedures to strike the right balance between process and protection.
No, I agree with both Frederick and Alex's points. You know, I think that legislators need to not feel pressured by, you know, large business interests in how they craft the legislation. I think that, you know, we saw it in the United States in 2012. There was a bill that was proposed that was looking at, you know, the timely reporting of cyber incidents, and that was eventually killed because, you know, entities in the United States did not want to do that. And I think that they felt pressured, even though I think everybody outside looking in said, hey, this would be great legislation. It would really help us secure cyberspace. But I think that the naming and shaming interests of a lot of organizations kind of killed that off. And I think that, you know, we're at a precipice, you know, where we have to do something now, or it's going to get worse. And you saw it in the United States with the Colonial Pipeline ransomware attack. I mean, that's a tiny indicator of what potentially a massive cyber attack like that could happen. What if it was, you know, the power grid or the financial sector, and now people can't get money out of their ATMs or they can't conduct financial transactions? And if we don't do something now, it's just a matter of time before we see a wide scale, massive cyber attack like that, that really impacts, you know, the globe, everybody, internationally, across all countries. And I think this is an opportunity where we can really recommend the timely reporting of information, the dissemination of that information, the sharing of that information across both the government and, you know, private organizations, to where we can all do something to prevent the next major cyber attack.
On that sober note, I would like to say, wow, thank you. I mean, as I keep saying, I'm a layperson. Sometimes it takes somebody like me to help open up the conversation in a way that lay people like myself can understand the gravity of the issues. I mean, you've just ended there, Matt, on a really serious note. And I think Frederick and I were talking about the role that these kinds of conversations can play in actually identifying the key issues, why they're a matter of urgency, and also thinking about ways in which there can be channels of communication developed between the academic centres and institutions of research, law enforcement officials like yourself, Matt, practitioners, legal practitioners like Frederick and Alex, and getting that information to the centres of lawmaking, whether it be policymakers or legislators, and the like. And we hope that this conversation, it might sound ambitious, but we hope this conversation can be heard by the right people as this new bill goes through the UK Parliament, and that it may be the beginning of fresh collaborations and important initiatives between our countries.
You know, I would love to build off of this momentum, perhaps, and maybe have the same people, you know, do some kind of, you know, webinar or something with King's College and my new firm that I joined, Kroll, because there's been some really interesting collaboration between King's and Kroll in the past. And some, when I let them know about this, they seemed really interested in progressing it further.
Amazing.
Yeah, I think there's some really good opportunities, which, you know, go back to the public-private partnership that we were all 100% espousing earlier today. So,
100%. Yeah, I think we'd be thrilled. Stuff. Yeah, we'd be thrilled to cooperate on a seminar series. That would be fantastic. I would love to be involved with that. Yeah. In view of the time, I would just like to say thank you so much for your expertise, for your time, for your generosity in being here today and making this conversation possible. And I've learned so much today. Take care. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Hannah.
Bye.
See you guys again, too. Yeah,
thank you, though.
This podcast is brought to you by the Dixon Poon School of Law at King's College London. Subscribe to The Verdict wherever you listen to your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Instagram at KCL_law, and follow the Dixon Poon School of Law on LinkedIn.